Okay, got it. Thank you, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here. It's always an honor to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, my name is Deanna R. My sobriety date is 1/14/14, and I am a recovered alcoholic. That's only by the grace of God and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do want to preface what I'm going to say today with the fact that this is my experience. I've spoken for a lot of groups over a number of years, and sometimes people get mad at me for the things that I say. This is my experience. What the book says is that the book has no monopoly on God, right? There are lots of different ways to get sober. What my experience is that it's only been the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous straight out of the big book, worked in order from step one all the way to step 12, is what has caused me to recover. And not only recover, but be happy, joyous, and free. Live a great life and, you know, not have to worry about this thing we call alcoholism, which is the side effect of the spiritual program. So a little bit about myself. So I started drinking super, super young. I think I was probably 10 or 11, the first time I tried alcohol. I distinctly remember that time. It was me and one of my little friends. We shared a half gallon of Malibu rum. So definitely abnormal right from the very start, for sure. But I was always a super shy girl, super shy girl. Stood in the corner, only speak when spoken to, thought what I said would be stupid or that people didn't like me. I was never the outgoing person, center of attention kind of thing. Always the shy girl. And so I distinctly remember when I had the feeling of being buzzed, of being that, you know, drunk feeling, and I had a feeling of confidence. And I love that. I've always been tall. And so I put on my mom's bikini and we went to the pool and I was talking to all the boys and all the boys were talking to me and I was laughing and we were having fun and I didn't feel self-conscious. And I just remember thinking to myself, this is what I need to do for the rest of my life. And again, I'm 10 or 11, right? It's funny to think about today, but I just knew like that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life because I just felt like everybody else was here and I was down here. Right. And when I drank that first time, I rose up and I was even with everybody else. And I just wondered, like, why had my parents been keeping this from me my whole life? Again, 10 or 11. But I chased that feeling. And the feeling that I got was that confidence, good enough, smart enough, pretty enough. And those were the things that I had always lacked. So I chased that feeling. And of course, you know, being a kid, you can't really get that much alcohol. You can get outside issues a lot easier. And so, you know, I did both, but anytime that I could get my hands on alcohol, I would drink. And so fast forward to high school days, I just remember being the girl at the party and, you know, we would get alcohol from the sister and the brother and the parents and over here and over there, there wouldn't be that much alcohol. And so people at the party would drink, we would run out. And I just remember being the girl at the party that was like, where are we going to get more? How are we going to get more? Where can we get more from? And I would find somebody at the party who would go along with me and, you know, we would save the party is what I always thought, you know, that was my motto. But really what I was doing is I was pacifying that allergy in my body. Like, I didn't know that I had an allergy to alcohol. I didn't know once I put it in, I was going to be off to the races and my body was going to crave more. There wasn't really anybody else at the party that was doing that. I would find that one person and convince them to come along with me, but I was the only one that had to have more. And I just thought at that time, like, I want to have more fun than everybody else. I'm the life of the party, right? I want to have, you know, a great time and I want everybody else to have a great time. And so that's what I always chalked it up to. I had a lot of consequences when I was early in my early stages of drinking. I was drinking as much as I could and I was drinking as often as I could. I was in the juvenile penitentiary by the time I was 15. and my mother, who loved me more than anybody else in this whole world and whom I loved more than anybody else in the whole world, would come to the jail, and she would cry to me, and she would say, "Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this?" And I couldn't really give her an answer. I didn't know why I was doing it. I didn't necessarily want to be a bad person, because that's what everybody told me when I was a kid. You're a bad girl. You're a bad girl. You're a bad girl. I didn't want to hurt people. I didn't want to hurt my mother. It killed me that I was hurting her. But I just felt, and I knew in my heart of hearts, like, she didn't understand. She didn't understand me. I knew that she didn't understand me. And I just kept thinking, like, if you knew what was inside here and what was inside here, you would understand why I have to keep doing this. She didn't understand. And it says it in the doctor's opinion. It's on page XXVIII. It's in the middle of the page there. And what it says is, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. And that's what her message was to me. Frothy emotional appeal. It's like the froth on a beer, right? We don't want it. It's just there. It's froth. It doesn't do anything, right? And her crying to me that frothy emotional appeal, it didn't do anything. On the next sentence in that same paragraph, it says, the message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. Her message didn't have depth and weight for me because she didn't understand, right? And so I kept drinking, and I kept having all of these consequences. Consequences, by the way, didn't make me alcoholic. I thought for the longest time that consequences is what made you alcoholic, right? I saw the bums under the bridge drinking out of paper sacks. I heard people getting divorced. I heard people about, you know, they're losing their jobs, and all these things, getting locked up in jail. And while I had a lot of those consequences didn't make me alcoholic. I had a lot of friends who had the same consequences, but when they had a sufficient reason, they could stop. And it also says that in the big book too, when it's talking about the types of drinkers. We have the moderate drinker, the heavy drinker, and the real deal chronic alcoholic. The heavy drinker looks exactly like me. My friends, they looked exactly like me. But when they got that DWI, or they got locked up in jail, or their parents were kicking them out, or they were getting suspended from school, they stopped, right? And they never went back to it. What I didn't understand at that point is that my mind was different too. It wasn't just my body that was different. I had that allergy of the body, but my mind was different too than the heavy drinkers, right? Because they could choose not to do it. And what I didn't realize is I didn't have that choice anymore. For me, I believed that I was alcoholic from the very first time that I drank. It doesn't mean that if you started moderately, that you can't be alcoholic now. So the cool part about this book is it goes into a lot of different explanations and a lot of different stories of different ways that we started drinking. And so I didn't realize that either. I didn't realize that we could all start different. Some of us start drinking alcoholically, and some of us start moderately, and somewhere across that invisible line into alcoholism. But it did. For me, it started out alcoholic right from the very start. And alcohol was never a problem for me. Never, never, never. It was the solution to my problem. How do I know that? Because why was the first time I decided, when I felt that buzz, that I was going to do it again? Well, because it was a solution for the way that I felt. So on the bottom of that same page in the doctor's opinion, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Understatement of the century, right? I didn't like the effect produced by alcohol. I love the effect produced by alcohol. But what it says on the next sentence is the sensation. So that love that I have for alcohol, it's elusive. What does elusive mean? It means that I can't catch it. So I remember that first time I got drunk, but I didn't get like blackout drunk. I got buzzed, right? I came up to here. After that first time, my allergy was set off in my body the other times that I drank after that. And so I didn't stop at the buzz point. I went over the top every single time. So why it says is that love, that sensation is elusive, is because I'm looking for this sensation, this buzz sensation, that right? That ease of restless, irritable, and discontented. That's what I wanted. But when I got to that spot, my body would say, yes, more, right? We need more. This feels good. We need to feel better. That feels great. We need to feel better. And so I would be off to the races and I would go off the top every single time. And that's why the sensation is elusive. It's because I have that allergy of the body and I can never quite catch it. At the top of that page in the doctor's opinion, he goes into detail about this allergy of the body. And what he says is that we have an allergy as it results as a phenomenon of craving. And what I also didn't realize for a really, really long time when I was drinking is that that craving was beyond my control. I remember being, you know, a young adult and realizing that I was crazy and that I hurt my friends and I hurt my family and that I would do stupid stuff and that I would get arrested. So I would tell one of my friends, I would say, hey, don't let me drink more than a couple glasses of beer, right? Or a couple glasses of wine or whatever it was. Don't let me drink more than that, because that's all I wanted to drink, because I knew if I had more than that, that I would just be going crazy, right? I would be in blackout mode. I would be hurting friends and family. I might go to jail. And so I would tell my friend, don't let me do that. But what I didn't realize and understand at that time is that I had this allergy of the body. And once that alcohol hit my body, because I was an alcoholic, that craving was set off, and that craving is insatiable. I don't have control over that craving, right? I have no willpower in my body to control that craving, no more than somebody who's allergic to strawberries, peanuts, or penicillin, right? If I give somebody $1 million who's allergic to strawberries and say, don't break out in hives, don't have an allergic reaction, you know, do your power of will. They're not going to be able to do that. Just like I'm not able as an alcoholic to control this allergy in my body, no matter how much the desire, the wish. Because at some point I had the desire and wish to control how much I drank. I just could not do that. And also what it says in here is these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. I used to drink bottles of NyQuil, y'all, bottles. I thought I was just being young and dumb, right? But my body didn't know the difference between NyQuil and Jack Daniels, right? I put NyQuil in, it's 10% alcohol, and my body said, yes, okay, Deanna, let's have more, more, more. This insatiable craving that can never be filled. And it was set off. So that happened to me for a long time. And that's why I say I know I was an alcoholic right from the very start, because this allergy of the body was there. And when I wasn't drinking, I was constantly thinking about how am I going to drink? When am I going to get it? Who do I need to lie to? When's the next time I can do it? Fast forward into young, you know, I graduated high school, I was working, I was in my early 20s, and I started drinking a lot. I started blacking out, crazy, crazy blacking out. I'd never blacked out up to that point. And really what I thought to myself is I should go to the doctor and find out what's wrong with my body, right? Because again, alcohol is not my problem. It never has been. Alcohol is the solution to my problems. So it did not cross my mind that I was drinking too much, ever. I thought something was wrong with my body. That's why I was blacking out. And I thought about going to the doctor. And y'all, I didn't go, but I just can't imagine what the doctor would have said to me. It's like, how much are you drinking, right? But that wasn't in my mind, because my mind was sick. My mind was saying, you know, it's not the alcohol, right? It's alcohol is not the problem. And I found out later that alcohol, it was true, alcohol wasn't the problem, but my mind continued to lie to me. So continuing on that page on the doctor's opinion, it says, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. What was the truth? The truth was, is I had this allergy of the body, and once I put it in, I was off to the races every single time. What was the false? The false was what my mind continued to lie to me and tell me. It told me all kinds of lies. It told me the cops were against me. I believed that the cops were against me. I thought, you know what? They have my picture on their dashboard, you know, and as soon as they see me, they're like, oh, there she is. Go get her. Right? I went to jail lots of times. I have 2 DWIs, PIs. I've been locked up probably about 15 times, maybe more. And I just thought the cops were against me. I thought my friends were against me. My friends were really mean to me. I thought my family didn't like me. These are the lies that my mind continued to tell me. You know, this time it's going to be different. I heard that a lot. I heard my mind told me that over and over and over again. And honestly, it wasn't until I came to the rooms of AA at 22, and actually sat down and listened, because I'd been to AA before. When I was in the juvenile penitentiary, they made us go, and I wasn't ready at that time. I was 15 or 16, and it was a bunch of old dudes talking about war stories, and I wasn't there. You know, I just thought, I'm just young, and I'm being dumb, and I'm living life, and blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't until my second DWI that I realized that, oh, I might have a problem here. I want to quit. I want to stop for good and all. And I kept finding that I couldn't do that. I couldn't moderate first because, let's be honest, I didn't try to quit all the way first. I tried to moderate, right? Don't drink before 5. Don't drink on weekends. You know, whatever I tried to do. Don't drink beer. Just drink wine. Don't drink at the bar, only drink at home. Don't drive, walk, right? I got an apartment by a bar and I walked instead of driving. Apparently you have to be able to walk home from the bar as well, right? PI. There were so many things that I tried that were false, and it was my mind, right? So let's flip, keep your finger on that page. We're going to come back, but let's flip over to Real Numbers, page 24. So on page 24, I'm just going to start at the top there, and it says, at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. I had a powerful desire to stop drinking at 22. I had my second DWI. The judge was looking at my face and saying, Deanna, I'm going to send you to prison. You're going to go to prison, right? I had a powerful desire to quit drinking, to stop drinking, but I found that I could not do that on my own willpower. I tried on my own willpower to stop, and my mind kept leading me back to it over and over again. That's the sad part about my truth as it refers to alcoholism, is it doesn't matter how much I want to stop. I can want to stop all day long. I can need to stop all day long. That's not a requirement for sobriety, really. What the requirement is that I'm willing to do what it takes to achieve sobriety, right? I'm willing to take some action in the program. I'm willing to follow some directions, not just about needing to do it, right? So it says, this tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. I believe, you know, long before I tried to quit drinking, I had an issue with it for sure. And I probably couldn't have stopped then either. Then it says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice and drink. I lost the power to choose. You know, I sponsor a lot of women, out there, and I've sponsored for many years, and a lot of them come back to me and they go, Deanna, I chose to drink. I said, did you? Because I remember doing this, pouring Jack Daniels down my throat and saying, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this. Where's my choice there? Right? There's been so many times when I did not want to do it. The last time I drank was 6 years ago. I've been in the program since 2006, right? The last time I drank 6 years ago, I did not want to drink. I didn't want to do it. But my mind told me, you don't have any other choice, Deanna. What other solution do you have, right? I've lost the power to choose whether I drink or not. It says our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. practically, I love that word practically, because sometimes I can have willpower to just not do it. Fear, the book says, fear sobers me up for a little bit. I don't know how long that little bit is, right? I think for some of us, we can endure larger amounts of pain than others. For me, I was able to endure a large amount of pain for about a year and a half, being dry. That willpower, that fear that I had of drinking again sobered me up for a bit. The fact is it's not about me not being able to stop. I can stop. I just can't stop from starting again, right? That's the problem, is I can't stop from starting again. So it says we're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, without defense against the first drink. So I love to tell a story about this part of the book. My first DWI, I was 19. I had been locked up many times previous to that DWI. When I got that DWI, I was in Austin, and I went to jail, and nobody came to get me because everybody was done with me. They were totally done with me, and they left me there. And I sat out that DWI. I got sentenced to 6 months, which was very lenient. It could have been longer. I did like work release, and I got out sooner than that. But I sat it out because my family and friends were completely done with me. I got out after I sat it out, and I didn't have any consequences, really. I didn't have probation. I didn't have community service. I didn't have to pay anything because I sat it out. And I just thought to myself, you know what, Deanna, you're just being young and dumb, right? I didn't think that alcohol was the problem. I thought that me being young and dumb was the problem, right? I had been mooching off anybody and everybody I could up to that point. I didn't have my own apartment. I didn't have my own car. I didn't have my own money. I wasn't in a relationship, which I thought was a part of being an adult as well. And so what I did at that point when I got out of jail at 19 is I made a commitment to get my life straightened out, cleaned up, grow up. And I did that. By the time I was 21, I was making over $100,000 a year at a new job. I had a brand new truck. I had a brand new apartment. I had a brand new boyfriend. And I just thought, okay, here we go, right? I exerted my power of will, and I got all of these things set up. Now, I did not stop drinking. I was still drinking, but I was moderating enough to get this stuff set up. But once I got this life set up for myself, I was like, okay, you know, hold is off. Let's get back to this drinking like I used to like to do it. And what happened was I was in Denton, Texas, and I had never lived there before. And me and my boyfriend were at the pool drinking one day, and we ate dinner, and I thought, oh, we're sober. Let's go out and drink. And so we went to the bar. I remember having one beer, and I don't remember anything after that. I was in a blackout. What I'm about to tell you was told to me. I don't even remember most of it. I remember part of it. But in Denton, it's a two-lane highway, and there's no median in the middle. I was driving in a blackout. I was swerving into oncoming traffic, swerving onto the exits. Five cars behind me called the police on me, and I got pulled over. Thank God for that, right? I could have killed somebody else. They gave me the sobriety test. Obviously, I was drunk in a blackout. And the first thing that I remember about this incident is crying in the back of the cop car. I wasn't crying because I had been arrested. I had been arrested many times up to that point. I was crying because I saw them arresting my boyfriend. And my boyfriend had no idea this is really who I was. He had not seen this person. And so they took us down to the jail, and it just so happened that my parents' neighbor is a Dick County deputy sheriff, and he was there. And he's a tall man, and he was yelling at me in this police department, right? You're so pretty. You're so smart. Why are you doing this? Look at yourself. You could have killed somebody. You could have killed yourself, like yelling at me in the middle of this police department. I'm 22. And I was humiliated. Y'all, I was humiliated, not only because he was yelling at me in front of everybody, but because he was right. I told myself I was never, ever going to be there ever again. I made that promise to myself, right? I cleaned my life up. I had this great job. I had this great car. I had this new apartment, this boyfriend, like, what was I doing here? In jail, again, right? And I spent the night on the cold jail floor, and they let me out the next morning because my friend was my police officer that worked there. And I walked home, and it was the walk of shame, right? I was wearing something scantily clad, I'm sure, and walking home in the cold weather, and I just felt terrible. And I got home, and I went to sleep, and I want to give y'all one guess at the first thing I thought when I woke up the next morning. Drink would be nice. Let me read that sentence again. It says, we're unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness, my mind, with sufficient force, the memory of the suffering and humiliation a week or a month ago. What about the night before? I could not bring into my consciousness the next morning the suffering and humiliation that had just went on hours before. Hours before. You know what my mind told me? My mind told me, Deanna, that cop was picking on you. You were one exit away from your apartment. He could have dropped you off at your apartment. You know, your cop friend, what an asshole. What an asshole for yelling at you in the middle of that police department. How dare he, right? You're a great driver when you're drunk, Deanna. You're a great driver, right? You weren't that drunk. You weren't that drunk. You ate dinner before y'all went to the bar. Yeah, you were in a blackout, but you black out all the time. You probably weren't that drunk. Right? Let's go back over to that doctor's opinion and that page we had our finger in, page XXIII. At the bottom, it says they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. Y'all, if my body was my only problem, I would be like the person who's allergic to strawberries and I would never put alcohol into my body ever again. But I am not that girl. I am the girl when out there is absolutely zero alcohol in my body, my mind lies to me and tells me the false and leads me right back around to that drink. And that was my experience my whole life drinking, is that I would get restless, irritable, and discontented, like it says here. My mind would start talking to me and tell me it was a good idea again. I would believe my mind because we believe our mind. Right? Why do I believe my mind? Because it keeps me safe in every single other aspect of my life. My mind says, Deanna, don't walk out on the highway. You're going to die. I believe my mind because it's right. My mind says, Deanna, don't put your hand on a hot stove. You're going to burn yourself. I believe my mind because it's right. But when alcohol is involved, I am strangely insane. Strangely insane. My mind keeps telling me this time it's going to be different. This time it's going to be different. It's the college town you were living in. It's the cops. It's the people picking on you. It's the bartender. It's the type of brand. It's the person you're with. Whatever my mind needed to tell me to get me to believe that it was right, I would. And I would drink again. My allergy would be set off and I would be off to the races every single time. And it wasn't until I stepped into the rooms of AA in 2006 that I felt for the first time that people understood me, because I knew that there was something wrong with me. I knew that I drank different than other people around me. I just thought I was a bad person, right? So on the preface, or I'm not sorry, not the preface, the forward to the first edition, page XIII, and that first full paragraph, it says, many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. When I came to AA, I realized for the first time that I was not bad. Mind blower, right? I thought I was bad the whole time. People told me that. I started this deal young, and people said, Deanna, you're a bad girl. You're a bad girl. You're a bad girl. You're a bad girl. And I believed it. I believed that I was bad. And it wasn't until people started talking about their experience around me and talking about how alcoholism is a disease that I realized, oh my gosh, I'm not a bad person. I'm a sick person. I don't have control over this mental obsession. I don't have control over this body piece, right? And so for the first time, I felt not alone anymore. I felt like there were other people in the world who knew exactly how I felt. And what my experience was is that first AA group that I went to, they didn't really explain to me the mental piece and the body piece. But when I sat down in the meeting and they started telling their story, I knew I was like them, because they were telling me things that I had only thought in my mind. I'd never heard anybody say it. And they drank like I did. And when they really, really wanted to stop, they could not, right? And I had that experience. Now, granted, I was 22 and there were some old timers in there that tried to deter me and say, what are you doing here? I drank more, I spilt more than you drank, right? You still wearing your watch? Because I hadn't lost everything at 22 when I came to AA, y'all. I still had the great job. I still had the boyfriend. I still had the apartment, right? I didn't have the divorce and homeless and all of these things that other people had had yet. Some people even told me, well, you haven't hit your bottom yet, Deanna. You haven't hit your bottom yet. And I hated that. And I still hate that saying today. Because if y'all gave me a shovel right now and I went outside and started digging a hole, where's the bottom? China? I don't know. That's what they tell us, right? The bottom of my hole is when I stop digging the hole. When I put down the shovel and I'm willing to take some action and I'm willing to do some different stuff, that's the bottom of my hole. Just because I've been sober for 6 years doesn't mean I'm not eligible to pick up that shovel again and go outside and start digging my hole deeper, right? The bottom is when I'm willing to stop and to take some action to do something about it, right? And when I went to that AA group when I was 22, I was willing. They told me a lot of funny things there. They told me, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days, get your butt in a seat, hug everybody that walks through the door, clean ashtrays, make coffee and share about your day, put your number on the wall. And I did all that and all went well for a time. Nobody told me that I needed to buy a book. Nobody told me I needed to work the steps. They told me that they would love me into sobriety and wait till the miracle happens. And I did that. I was the poster child for AA. I had the AA bracelet, the AA ring, and the AA earrings, you know, like I had it all. And I didn't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I went to 3 meetings a day, 7 days a week. And it was all good. It was all good for a while because I felt like what the book talks about, that camaraderie, like we were on a wreck in the same vessel, in the same shipwreck. I found that camaraderie in AA. Made me feel really good. And I didn't drink and I didn't really think about drinking for a while. But then came the day about a year and a half into that when I started having really bad panic attacks. And I got a sponsor, but she didn't work me from the steps out of the book. She gave me a worksheet she had gotten from treatment. I did that worksheet. She had me write my life story and burn it. she had me call me. She said, call me when your ass is on fire, right? And so I did that and I would call her and she would say, did you turn your will over today? I said, did I ask God to take my will? Did I pray to God? Yes, I did. Okay. How many meetings have you went to today? I've been to 3. Okay. Well, I guess you don't want it bad enough is what she would say to me. And I would say, how much more bad do you want me to have it? I've been to 3 meetings today. I'm praying to God, like, you know, no one else exists in the world. And I'm calling you, how much more bad do you want me to have it? And I just couldn't understand, why is this not working for me? And here I am, I'm different than everybody else again, which is exactly the way I felt before I came to AA, right? I'm different than everybody else. And what my experience was, is I knew this guy that was like annoyingly happy. You know those guys, just annoyingly happy. I think I'm that girl now. I'm the annoyingly happy one. Right. And, but he had something, like there was something I could see about him that he was different. Like I liked the people in my group, but they were just kind of grumpy. They were kind of grumpy and they were kind of like just talking about how shitty their life was and how shitty their day was. And they were kind of depressing. And I heard the same stories over and over again in my group. And, you know, there just wasn't really any hope in that for me. Everybody told me I'd be recovering my whole life. I don't know. I didn't want what they had and I wanted what this annoyingly happy guy had. And so I went to him and I was like, man, like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? Because I need to be doing what you're doing because I want to drink. And I knew I was going to drink because the level of pain, emotional pain that was in my body, I knew I was going to drink. And I went to him and he said, you know what, Deanna, like one of the guys from my group, it was Primary Purpose Group in Dallas. is speaking tonight at your group. Why don't you go listen to him? And I was like, oh, those PPG guys, like, yeah, I heard about big book thumpers. They're cocky and this and that. And they were infamous at our group for not in a good way, right? And he goes, well, you know what? Well, obviously what you're doing isn't working for you. So maybe you should go listen to this guy. I said, well, I am desperate. I do feel like I'm going to drink. And he says, okay, come listen to this guy. And if you still want to drink, go drink. And I was like, oh my God, I could not believe he told me to go drink if I wanted to still go drink. I was like, I thought we were friends, bro, you know? and so I went and I listened to this speaker, and he said a lot of different things that I'd never heard before, ever. The first thing was, is he presented himself as a recovered alcoholic, which I thought was pretty cocky. I was like, woo, recovered alcoholic. What I didn't know is on the very first page of this book where it says Alcoholics Anonymous in big letters on the top, it says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism, right? What I was doing at the time was recovering from alcoholism. What that meant was, is I was suffering from the effects of alcoholism. And what I didn't understand is if I worked the steps out of this book, that I could recover. What I could recover from is the mental obsession. That's what I'm recovered from today. I don't think about drinking and I don't think about not drinking. Is my allergy in my body ever going to be recovered? Absolutely not. But I'm not suffering from the effects of alcoholism today. And that's what recovered meant. That's what he meant when he said he was recovered. The second thing was, is he read out of the book, which I thought was really cocky too. I was like, ooh, you can read, right? but he said a lot of things that were really different than the things that I had heard before. And I went up to my friend after the meeting and I was like, dude, I don't get it. What is this guy talking about? Is this like NA or CA or DAA? Like, what is he talking about? And he goes, Sienna, he's speaking out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You have one of those, right? I was like, I don't know. Yeah, maybe at my house somewhere. I think I use it as a coaster or something. And he goes, okay, here's a number. The lady, a lady that can sponsor you from my group, give her a call right now. Work the steps. So this is okay. I'm desperate. I know that I'm going to drink. This guy's saying some weird stuff that I haven't heard before, and I like it. I can relate with it. And so I called this lady, and she worked me through the steps. We were through step 9, and I was making amends 2 weeks into it. By the third week, I was doing 10. By the fourth week, I was doing 11. And by the fifth week, I was doing 12, and I was carrying the message. And I want to tell y'all that once I got up to that ninth step 2 weeks into it, those panic attacks stopped. What my sponsor didn't tell me, and I love her to death, she was just doing what she thought was the best, but it didn't work for me. It worked for her. It didn't work for me. But what she should have been saying to me is when I called and I said, I feel like drinking, I'm having panic attacks, I'm in fear, I'm da-da-da-da, when she said, did you turn your will over? What she should have been saying if she was working me out of the book is, did you do a 10th step today? Did you do an 11th step today? Are you doing step 12? Who did you help, right? And she didn't know to do that. And so what the difference was is when I worked the steps out of the book with this new sponsor, that's what she did, right? She explained to me also step 1. It says we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. The group that I went to said, Deanna, you're powerless over people, places, and things. That might be true, but that's not what step 1's talking about. Powerless means I am powerless over this body allergy and I am powerless over this mental obsession, right? The second piece of step 1 is that our lives had become unmanageable. The unmanageability didn't come from my consequences. I bet to guess that there are millionaires up in their mansions drinking themselves to death right now. Consequences don't make me alcoholic. What makes me alcoholic is me being unable to manage the decision in my mind to never take another drink again. Left up to my own devices, trying to use my body and my mind to overcome alcoholism. Remember, I'm like a dog chasing my tail, right? I say I'm never going to do it again, and then I do it. My allergies set off. I get so drunk, something happens. I say I'm never doing that again. I make a resolution. I get restless, irritable, and discontented. Here I go again, right? That's me left up to my own devices. If I know my truth in step one, which I do, is that I am going to drink forever no matter what. That's still my truth today, right? I'm 6 years sober, and that's still my truth today. If I don't continue to do 10, 11, and 12, the mental obsession will come back, and I will drink again. That is a fact. It's not that I can't drink. I hear women say that to me all the time, but I can't drink anymore, Deanna. I can't drink anymore. And my answer is you can't. And you will if you're a real deal chronic alcoholic, not just that heavy drinker, right? And so, you know, I learned what step one really, really meant. It wasn't just saying my name's Deanna and I'm an alcoholic. It was admitting that I had that allergy of the body and I had that mental obsession for sure. And there wasn't a dang thing that I could do about it left up to my own devices. And once I knew that in step one, I was able in step two to realize that there had to be a power out there greater than myself that could possibly just maybe save my life. And once I realized that in step two, then I was able to make that decision in step three. When my sponsor said, did you turn your will over to God? I didn't know how to do that, right? In step three, I'm not doing anything. I'm just making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I don't know how to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. What I didn't understand for the longest time as well is that, you know, the steps are designed for living. It says, Deanna, do this when you wake up. Do this when you go to bed. Do this when you get angry. Do this when you get resentful. Right? The 12 steps are how I'm going to live the rest of my life. It's showing me how I turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Because me by myself, I don't know how to do that. If I knew how to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I would just be like, God, take it. And I would be like, oh, saved. And I would be good. But I don't know how to do that. And that's why those foxhole prayers, that's why simply, you know, for me, just trying to go to church, those things didn't work because it didn't give me a discipline. It didn't give me that daily discipline to unblock myself from God. Really, I'm not unblocking myself. I'm allowing God to unblock me. But it didn't give me that discipline that I really, really needed to live, you know, by relying on God. And once I got down to the end of the steps and I started relying on God, I started realizing it wasn't just about belief, right? It was about me putting God into every single aspect of my life, my job, my kids, my relationship. And when I did that, when I worked the steps 1 through 12, like it's just as it's outlined in the book, and I dedicated my life to carrying the message to the alcoholic who is still suffering out there, which is my responsibility as a recovered alcoholic to do that, then I recovered, right? Then I became happy, joyous, and free. Then alcohol is out of the picture. Alcohol is not drinking as a side effect of this amazing life that God has given me today. So today, what I get to do is exactly what I'm doing for y'all tonight. Bearing witness. And I'm not bearing witness of my, you know, awesomeness, my coolness, my ability to speak, my greatness. No. What does it say in the third step prayer? Is that I'm bearing witness for God's love, God's power, God's way of life. He gave me this. You're looking at a girl without this spiritual program of action would be way too shy and self-conscious and embarrassed and all that to speak in front of anybody. God gave me this, right? And as a result of just simply following some directions, being willing to take some action, and being consistent in a program, because that's the most important part, is that when I'm on the mountain of sobriety and alcohol's down here, God's up here, I can go up, up, up towards that mountain. And as long as I keep going up and I don't stop, because I'm going to slide backwards, right? Mountains, you don't stay still. You're either going up towards spirituality or you're going back down towards alcohol. And as long as I'm having that uphill climb consistently towards God in a spiritual program, I don't have to get back down towards that alcohol ever again. And permanent sobriety is attainable through this program. if I just keep doing what I'm supposed to be doing, take some direction and work these steps. So thank you all so much for letting me share. And I'm going to put my name and my phone number in the chat if anyone is looking for a speaker or sponsorship or just someone to talk to, or y'all have any questions for me at all. Please get with me after the meeting, and I will be happy to do that for you. Thank you so much.